From WNYC, this is The Sporkful.
One of my favorite things about doing this show is finding out that there are so many of you who are as weird and obsessive about eating as I am. Today on The Sporkful, we're letting our freak flag fly. I'll talk to an eater in LA who makes me look like I walk the straight and narrow, all right? This guy always orders the same thing as the person to his right, no matter what.
And I asked myself, Adam, why are you looking at a sign in front of a Mexican restaurant? I've been ordering burritos, Mexican food for 25 years, you know what's on the menu. This is stupid.
Also, Ira in Colorado likes to store peanuts in his cheeks.
It's usually on the lower left side, between jaw and cheek.
I'll analyze his approach. And you've heard of people who don't like different foods on their plate to touch, right? Well, we'll hear from a woman in Indiana who takes that policy to an extreme. Wait till you hear how she organizes her closet. But let's start with this.
Hi, this is Larry calling from New York.
All right, Larry, what's on your mind?
So the other day, I was walking through the park having a jelly donut, and I ran into this issue of wondering what level the donut should be filled at, because the one I was having as I was going through and you get towards the center had too much jelly in it, in that it was coming out. And I wasn't sure if I should lick that jelly up, should I try and smear it to the side, or what is the right level of proper jelly filledness of a donut?
Well, Larry, you've raised a really vital and valid concern here with jelly donuts in general, which is that they're kind of a mess. You get this big blob of jelly in the middle that is kind of gross. Like, it's often not very good jelly. And even if it is good jelly, you don't usually want a huge mouthful of jelly. The other problem with the big glob in the center is that you get these perimeter bites that have no jelly. And you're always
exactly.
Kinda, you're like tentatively nibbling around the perimeter, like wondering when you're going to break through. Because, you know, the second you break through, like, all hell is going to break loose. And to me, this is really a sign of that the whole food is faulty. So I don't think there's anything wrong with using a knife. But I think that really we're asking the wrong question here. Or, you know, we can talk about how to deal with a jelly donut, but really what we should be asking is, how can we make the jelly donut better so that we don't have this problem in the first place? You're lucky that you live in New York, Larry, because you live near Donut Plant, which is a place that I recommend, and there are probably other donut places around the country that do this. If not, I hope they're listening. Because Donut Plant has solved the jelly donut. Do you know what they do?
They do the square donuts.
Hey, guys, it's Dan here in the present, interrupting. In listening back to this, I don't think my description of the Donut Plant technique was very clear. So the Donut Plant filled jelly donut is a square donut with a hole in the middle. So it's essentially four straight lines that come together to form a square. And the fact that they're straight is the key, because you inject the jelly into the donut. So the classic jelly donut, you stick a syringe into the middle of it and put this one big blob of jelly in the middle. With the four straight lines of the square Donut Plant donut, that way you get a thin ribbon of jelly throughout, a little bit of jelly in each bite. It's pretty amazing. You got to try it. Now back to my conversation with Larry.
I totally agree. I mean, I love Donut Plant, and I think that their jelly method is superior.
How do you feel about my statement that it's okay to use a knife?
I don't agree with the statement about the knife, because if you're not given a knife, it's sort of like a bagel. They cut it in half for you, and you can take the bagel, you can eat it like that. But if you're just sort of taking a donut for the ride, and you have the cellophane wrapper that they give you, and you don't have one with you, you're sort of out of luck.
Well, let's see if maybe there's a happy medium we can reach here, Larry, for the faulty classic jelly donut. What about a tear and dip method? What if you were to tear, let's say you were to sort of hold the jelly donut in your hand, not flat, but on its side, and you tear off a little piece and you keep tearing delicately until you have access to the well, to the glob in the middle, and you tear and then you dip and you tear and you dip. So you can spread the jelly. Now, it's good. Even that's going to get messy. But as we said, that's going to happen no matter what.
I think that's the perfect solution. I think that's actually brilliant.
The tear and the dip. Have you tried that? The tear and the
dip?
No,
I'm definitely going to try that, though. I think that's really, really brilliant. Cut it, then you can sort of take it out, and then you can evenly spread out your jelly across the donuts. You're sort of leveling out the jelly so you can avoid the blob.
That's right. You're correcting the mistake that the inventor of the jelly donut made oh so many years ago.
That's brilliant. I'm totally going to try that.
All right, Larry, I want you to try that, and then I want you to call me back and let me know how it goes.
I will absolutely call you back, Dan.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Now, back to the phones. Hi, who's this?
Hi, this is Adam from Los Angeles.
Hey, Adam, what can I do for you?
Hey, I've got a unique dining method. I don't look at menus.
Really? Has this always been the case?
What happened was I stopped at a Mexican restaurant and was standing out front looking up at the sign, and I asked myself, Adam, why are you looking at a sign in front of a Mexican restaurant? Been ordering burritos and Mexican food for 25 years. You know what's on the menu. This is stupid. So it was right then and there that I said, stop looking at menus in Mexican restaurants. And I think it was about March, and I hadn't made a New Year's resolution yet. So that became my New Year's resolution for that year, to stop looking at menus in Mexican restaurants.
So you made your New Year's resolution in March. Maybe your New Year's resolution next year should be to make your New Year's resolution on time. But anyway, so go on. So you resolved to not look at menus in Mexican restaurants, and that, am I right in assuming that that eventually expanded to not looking at menus at all?
Yes. And then from there, that had to be adapted to just order what the guy ahead of you in line orders. There's three rules, and that is you can only order what the person to your right orders or ahead of you in line, whichever. Rule number two is beverages don't count. And number three is you can adapt the order for safety.
So it's evolved over time. You started off saying no menus at Mexican restaurants. That became no menus anywhere. And that became, not only will I not look at the menu, but I'm always going to order the thing the person ahead of me orders. Am I correct here, Adam, that part of the reason why you're calling in is that you feel like other people might want to try to observe these same rules? So make the pitch. Speak to the Sporkful listeners out there. Convince them. Why is this a way they should be eating?
I think it is important to remove one's subjectiveness from life. Out here in Los Angeles, we're pretty isolated. We get in our silent little cars and drive to our little jobs and are in our own little worlds a lot. And to order food that's not something that we order ever kind of removes us from ourselves. And maybe if we can do that with... when it comes to ordering, we can do that in other facets of life. On the other hand, it could just be that I'm extraordinarily lazy.
But it sounds like
exactly the case.
It sounds like the case that you're making is sort of that you're saying people need to kind of let go a little bit.
Yeah, you don't need to be in control all the time.
Okay. Adam, I think it's an interesting concept that you raise. I would never go as far as you've gone because I would not leave to chance that which can be made more delicious by choice. However, I think that you have an interest, you've hit upon something interesting in the idea of being less reliant on menus and being more reliant on kind of feeling out the situation, looking at what other people in the restaurant have, asking them questions, talking to your server. And I think there is something kind of fun about the adventure of kind of going into a restaurant and feeling it out. But I will not go with you on as far as you're willing to go to just say I'm going to automatically take whatever the person on my right takes. Because then, I mean, who the hell knows what that person is eating?
However, I have eaten things that I would never otherwise eat, like pastrami. Somebody was ordering pastrami, and I said, I'll have that, whatever it is. And I bit into it, and I thought, holy smokes, this is great. That never would have happened had I not ordered what somebody else ordered.
Well, that's interesting. I guess maybe in your case, Adam, it is a pretty good policy. I just feel like I would never want to be in the situation. Like, I've talked here, let's hear a good example. I've talked here on the Sporkful, but that, you know, you don't want more than two or three toppings on a pizza pie. All right, they said these pizzas have got sausage and pepperoni and mushrooms and onions and peppers and broccoli. It's an abomination. It's too heavy. It's too soggy. It ruins a pizza. If I was following your rule and someone handed me one of the, like a pizza with all that junk on it, I would be pissed. I would be like, why did I follow Adam's stupid rule? Now I'm stuck with soggy, nasty pizza. So,
fair enough, but if I followed your rule, I never would have tried a Hawaiian pizza.
Well, that would be a good thing, because Hawaiian pizza is gross.
Fair enough.
I do think what you're saying is an interesting concept. I do think that there is some merit to kind of feeling out the eating situation, and that it can be fun, it can be an adventure, and it certainly is a conversation starter. So, Adam in Los Angeles, thanks a lot for the call.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Coming up, you've heard of people who don't like the foods on their plate to touch, right? Well, I'll talk to an eater in Indianapolis who takes this to a whole other level. Plus, an eater in Colorado has an elaborate system for storing peanuts in his cheeks. Stick around. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC. I'm Dan Pashman. You too can be a caller on a future episode of The Sporkful. If you've got a quirky approach to eating, an innovation, a rant, or maybe a debate that needs settling, I want to hear from you. Drop me a line at dan@sporkful.com or give me a call, 908-9-SPORK-9. We're taking your calls today and finding out just how awesomely weird we eaters of the Sporkful community can be. We're a little different from the general population, you and me. We're a special breed. And for more evidence of that, let's turn back to the phones.
Hi, this is Carrie from Indianapolis, Indiana. And I'm calling in today because I have long had a problem with food touching on my plate. This is a struggle for me not only on days where you eat a ton of food, like Thanksgiving, but it's also an everyday struggle when I go to buffets. I have to get multiple plates, go up tons of different times because I just can't stand it when the food touches and the flavors mingle together. I truly cringe.
So let me understand a little more about this, Carrie. So what about when foods are touching, like foods that tend to come together? Like, would you pour gravy on mashed potatoes?
Foods that are prepared together or made to go together, totally fine. That's a different ballgame. Mashed potatoes and gravy is a great example. Another one that people always ask me about when this comes up is, well, do you eat tacos? Absolutely. Of course, who doesn't eat tacos? But those foods are created to go together. Now, I will tell you, when I go to a Mexican restaurant and you know how they serve the rice and beans on the same plate, I will leave that sliver together where they're touching because I just don't like it.
So you'll eat all the beans and all the rice except for the thin line where they come together.
Yes.
What if the rice and beans are already mixed together? What if it's like a dish that it's just a type of rice that has beans in it?
I wouldn't order that dish again.
But why is that different from mashed potatoes and gravy? If I'm making a rice dish and beans is one ingredient in my rice dish, then it's meant to go together.
Well, yeah. Okay, so I see what you're saying there. And if it's something that you created together, I'll certainly try it.
Now, does this approach to eating, do we also see evidence of this kind of segmentation in other parts of your life? Like, tell me about your closet.
Oh, my gosh.
Go on.
It's color-coded. Not only is it color-coded, first it's broken out by sleeve length. So, like, the tank tops are color-coded, then the short sleeve, then the three-quarter sleeve, which, when those started becoming popular, just totally threw off my whole closet. And then long sleeve, and then I have a two-sided walk-in closet. The other side is all of my work clothes, and it follows the similar pattern.
Wow. That seems like a pretty good system.
I try.
So getting back to the food, it sounds like if we can sort of apply a sort of a Carrie doctrine—
Yes.
Here to when it's okay for foods to be mixed and when it's not. It's really like when it's one dish, one cohesive dish, then it can be as many things as you want in there. But
right.
If it's two different dishes, that's an issue.
Right.
I'm trying to find an example that would break the rule. The food that would break your rule, Carrie, would be some kind of a dish that a chef might design whereby the plate comes and there's two separate foods on the plate right. that are clearly separate from each other, but are designed and intended to be consumed together.
Oh, see, that's hard. Because, like, would you consider chicken parm with a side of spaghetti? Would you consider that?
No, I mean, that's, I mean, you can eat those things separately, but it's not like, it's not inherent to the dish.
Yeah.
Oh,
you're right.
All right. What about Peking duck?
Oh, I don't know that I've ever had it.
So here's how it works. You get a platter of the duck.
Okay.
And that's cooked and it's crispy with the skin and it's delicious. And then
okay.
sometimes at some restaurants, they'll make it, they'll put it into wraps for you table side, but let's say they don't. Let's say they just put it in front of you. You have one plate that's got duck, and then you have scallions,
okay.
finely shredded scallions, and sometimes maybe cucumber, and hoisin sauce, which is like a sweet, salty brown sauce. And then you have, for lack of a better analogy, a flour tortilla, although I know that it's not actually a flour tortilla,
yeah.
but it's comparable for our purposes. And what you would typically do is you would take your flour tortilla, you take a little hoisin sauce, spread it on the tortilla, put some duck meat, some scallions, some crispy skin, and you would roll it all up and eat it. And that's the way it's intended to be eaten.
Yeah, see, and I think I would totally be okay with that. Because in that sense, you have the vehicle, the tortilla, you have the meat, which, if I'm likening it to tacos, would be like the duck versus ground beef. And then you have your topping and a sauce. So to me, like, I would liken that to tacos, and that all was made to go together, so visually I perceive it as one whole.
So really, it's only about how it's intended. It's not about how it's presented.
Yeah, I think so.
And now, I mean, do you have a significant other in your life when you go on dates? Like, does this come up at restaurants?
Yes, actually, so I'm the kind of girl where I order my meal, and then I'm going to take a bite of yours 99% of the time. So my boyfriend found this out, and he's like, oh, I'm mixing all my food together, so you'll never touch my food again.
Smart man.
I know.
So last question, Carrie, like, is it something that you want to get over, or you feel like, eh, whatever, we're all quirky?
I think, you know, I think we all are quirky, and, you know, this is something that I can talk about and laugh about with my friends. You know, they poke fun at me, and I tell them that they're eating incorrectly. So I kind of like it.
All right. Well, Carrie in Indianapolis, thanks so much for your call. Keep those plates with all the dividers handy.
I will. Thanks, Dan.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Hi. My name is Ira. I'm from Colorado.
Hey, Ira. What's on your mind?
Well, I just got finished listening to your Peanuts and Cracker Jack episode. And I wanted to talk to you about a technique I've got for eating peanuts and other small food items.
Okay.
So when I'm eating peanuts, it's usually shelled peanuts, so something I've got to take out of a shell or some other encasing. If it's a small food item, I often store it in my mouth between my jaw and my cheek. And the reason I think I do this is, one, to sort of a time technique. I don't want to have to wait in between small bites. And the other reason is, you often talk about the tactile nature of eating, and I think I find a full mouthful of some particular food item more satisfying than several small bites.
Is this, where did this come from? What, do you remember the first time you ever did this?
I certainly did it as a child, because I recall my parents teasing me about it. I think it's, you know, partially I do other things with my hands. Maybe I'm reading a book, or, you know, if I'm at the game, maybe I'm keeping score or something. But also, you know, if it's a salty peanut or a pistachio or whatever, I get to suck the salt off.
But describe it to me a little bit more. So what is the largest number of peanuts you would typically store in your mouth at once before swallowing them? And exactly where in your mouth do you store them?
It's usually on the lower left side, between jaw and cheek.
You never go the right side?
I've never counted. Not as much. The only time I do right side, further weirdness, is sometimes I'll do this with cherries also. So I'll store the pits on the left side and the cherries on the right side. And then, of course, I need to be careful not to swallow pits.
You're very well coordinated.
I didn't think it took a lot of coordination to employ this particular technique. But
so you're saying that, like, one side of your mouth is for storing savory foods and the other side is for storing sweet foods?
It could be.
Okay. What's the rough average for the amount of time the nuts are stored in this spot before they're eaten?
Oh, I suppose it depends on what I'm doing. If I'm doing something where my attention is on other things and it's more passive activity, it could be several minutes. Maybe until I notice they're not salty anymore. Maybe until I realize I'm about to overload and cause some kind of a mess.
Right. I would think that even as crunchy as peanuts can be, that if you leave them in your mouth for that long, that they're going to start to get a little less crunchy. Is that a concern?
It's a feature, not a bug. They do definitely get softer sometimes. But it's, yeah, I don't consider that a downside necessarily. It's just something different. If I want it more crunchy, I've certainly got the option of storing them in my hand. But
I got to ask, like, has there been a significant other in your life, and how has this practice affected your relationship?
I don't recall that it's ever affected my relationship with my wife. You know, until I was listening to your podcast, it's something I did consciously, but not something I gave a great deal of thought to.
And do you have kids?
No, no kids. We're both teachers, so that's kids enough for us.
Okay. Well, what do you teach?
I am a librarian, a high school librarian, and we're both speech and debate coaches.
But have you tried to spread this technique to any of the students? I suppose that a mouthful of peanuts wouldn't be so good if you're engaging in speech and debate.
Right. That's a whole different topic.
Okay. Yeah. So, although maybe it can strengthen the certain mouth muscles that could allow someone to speak more clearly or improve diction. Maybe you could work on that, Ira.
There's sort of an apocryphal technique of putting marbles in the mouth to increase enunciation. I've never found it work, and I was always afraid a kid would swallow a marble. And that's a whole different problem for me.
That's right. Well, maybe you could try it with peanuts, Ira.
Maybe with peanuts. That might be a less dangerous way to go.
If it doesn't improve their diction, it will at least sate their appetites. Well, Ira in Colorado, enjoy those peanuts. Thanks for your call, man.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, this is Larry Fish from Manhattan calling back about my jelly donut incident.
All right, Larry, what's the report? Talk to me.
So, Dan, I tried the tear and dip method twice since we spoke, and the first time I sort of failed because I found that the key to making this method work is knowing where the epicenter of your jelly donut is. So what happened was the first time I tore too deep and the jelly just came out. So what you got to do is tear right before that epicenter so you can get that doughy part, squeeze out some of that jelly, and then you can even out your eating of the jelly and not lose anything.
Right, so it needs to be a subtle back and forth between tear a little, dip a little, squeeze a little, and repeat. You don't want to rip the donut in half on the first go. Is that what you're telling me, Larry?
Hey, that's exactly what I'm trying to tell you.
Great. So you're excited about this technique?
Yeah, it's a great technique. Works out really well.
All right, any other words of wisdom to share with people, Larry, based on your research?
Just keep eating lots of donuts. They're really delicious, and it works out really well.
All right. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks so much to everyone who called in to this week's show. Remember, if you've got a debate that needs settling or an eating innovation that the rest of us weirdos need to hear about, I want you to get in touch with me. Email me, dan@sporkful.com, or give me a ring, 908-9-SPORK-9. Next week, ahead of Valentine's Day, we'll talk eating in a relationship with the great Dan Savage. What do you cook for someone the morning after when you want them to stay, and what do you cook when you want them to leave?
Well, you pull out the stops if you want them to stay. You don't want to appear to be trying too hard. No eggs Benedict. You want to try hard and fail, because then what you said is, I suck at this cooking thing. And you don't want to, you know, overplay your hand.
That's next week. Follow me on Twitter @TheSporkful. And please, make sure you subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. That helps us out a lot, and it ensures that you will never miss an episode. Also, check out a cool food podcast called Gastropod. They explore the science and history of food from a wide range of angles, and this week their guest is me. And I think I did a pretty good job of pretending to know things about the science and history of food. I held my own. It was a lot of fun. Check it out. It's called Gastropod. This show is a production of WNYC and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani. Our web writers are Talia Ralph and Alight Trong. Special thanks to Chris Bannon. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.